Welcome to our CSIN podcast. My name is Ole. I'm the Director of Macroeconomic and Monetary Policy Management at the CSIN Center. I'm joined today by my colleagues Özdeğer Karagedikli, and our speaker today is Matteo Maggiori, who is an assistant associate professor of finance at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Matteo holds a PhD from the University of California at Berkeley, and if you know the history between the two places, he's a very brave man, moving from one place to the other. But in between, he also taught at Harvard in the economics department. The reason we're talking to Matteo today is to showcase a recent paper he wrote with two colleagues, Brent Nyman from Chicago and Jesse Schrager from Harvard, on international currencies and capital allocation. The aim of the paper is to shed light on how capital moves around the world. Now, this is I would very highly recommend this paper to you. There's a wealth of information in this paper on how capital moves around the world and some of the issues, pitfalls in terms of measuring capital and trying to get an adequate picture of capital flows. There are five people involved in this project. It's called the Global Capital Allocation Project, and it has its own website, so the authors make all the data and all the materials available. Now, Matteo, let me start by asking you how this project came about, this idea of untangling networks of cross-border capital flows, and maybe some of the sort of the big results that you found.
I mean, first of all, it's a pleasure to be here for this podcast, and I hope that you will find it useful. The project started with my co-authors, Brent Nyman, was at the University of Chicago, and Jesse Schrager was at Columbia, and now a number of years ago, 3 or 4 years ago. And it was really out of the desire to understand much better how capital gets allocated across the world. This is clearly a fundamental topic in international macroeconomics, but we had come to realize that a lot of our knowledge was based on extremely aggregate data sets, like the national statistics. And that instead, with the financial crisis of 2008, two things that really changed. One is more conceptual. There was a lot of interest in who owns what around the world, because all of a sudden we realized, or we put it more emphasis from a theoretical perspective, on the importance of understanding, either for distributional consequences or for positive economics, who owns the assets and how they allocate them. And the second thing that was happening, I think, at the same time, is that with the crisis and with the new regulation, a lot of data was being collected and becoming available for the first time on a grand scale, exactly about this, who owns which asset around the world. And so all of a sudden, this became a real possibility for us as researchers to make the investments to build this knowledge. And that's really where the project came from. And then over time, a number of papers have come out of it. And we've added some of the younger members to the team, and a wonderful team of RAs, and so this became more of a lab that we run all together, and it's been a wonderful experience.
Is it? Do you have a question?
May I start? I would like to start with a sort of a quote I really like from late Alan Kruger. Sometimes it is better to collect new data than applying new techniques to the old data. Late Alan Kruger said, which I really like. I believe a big part of your project is about data, and you allude to the inadequacies of the national or international aggregate statistics, like the balance of payment statistics and so on. Can we talk about these inadequacies in a bit more detail in national statistics?
Absolutely. So first of all, one can rarely disagree with Kruger, and it was clearly an immense loss to our profession. He has, I think he's correctly describing a wave of research that has gone through economics across fields, where all of a sudden the availability of extremely detailed microdata has allowed us to answer new questions, both for micro and for macro. Now, within the confines of international economics and finance, this has really come, at least from our side, from our research, from new data on who holds the assets, as I was mentioning before. And this has allowed us also, as you were pointing out, to tackle some outstanding issues in the field that I think many people have been aware for a long time. In particular, one that you mentioned is the presence of tax havens that make disentangling capital flows globally very difficult. Why? Because so much of the international capital flows pass through these very opaque financial centers that it's very difficult to figure out where ultimately the capital is lending. And so one of our most recent projects, it's called Redrawing the Map of Capital, of Global Capital Flows. And it's actually with it's together with Brent and Jesse, my usual co-authors, but also with a wonderful PhD student at Harvard, Antonio Coppola. And what this project is doing is it's trying to tackle these issues head on. And how do we do it and what comes out of it? Let me give you a brief idea. A lot of these securities are being issued by corporations that set up affiliates or subsidiaries in tax havens. So a Brazilian oil giant like Petrobras will have a subsidiary in the Cayman Islands or in the Netherlands, and the sole purpose of this subsidiary might very often be to issue debt securities. Now, there's a concept that applies to most national statistics. It's called residency. And if an American investor, for example, were to buy one of these bonds, this will show up as an asset that the US holds in the Cayman Islands against the financial company. Instead, as economists, we often tend to want to think of this asset as a claim of the US on a Brazilian oil company. And in the data, it's actually possible to do this. Now, if you wanted to do it for one or two companies, you can probably Google it, you could probably look at the balance sheet of each of these companies. It becomes more difficult once you're trying to do it for the universe of securities out there. We do it for about 28 million securities. And it also becomes more difficult if you want to do it systematically in a way that it's helpful to other researchers and it's replicable. And so that's really where the project started. It was creating a new map that takes each security around the world and tells you where it should go, where the ultimate parent is located, and who the ultimate parent company is. And then the second exercise was applying this map to a data set of who owns which securities around the world and look at basic facts of our field once you've transformed data in terms of the nationality of the ultimate parent company. And really from there, a number of interesting facts we think have emerged that have, are both interesting for economic theory, but also relevant for policy. And I'm sure that you know we can discuss this a little bit more in a second, but I wanted to first hear from you if you have other questions on this.
Yeah, I mean, a question I have is, so, I mean, what you say sort of makes me a bit worried because now about the sort of nature of the official statistics. So I'm kind of wondering to what extent your disaggregated data, if we were to add that up, does that come close to the aggregate numbers? Do you still find a good correspondence between at least the aggregate and the disaggregated numbers, or is there still stuff missing?
Absolutely. So this is an excellent question. So first, let me start from trying to understand what kind of data we use. So for most of the data that we have for holdings comes from open-end mutual funds and ETFs. These are clearly just one sector of the holders. They're clearly insurance companies, there are pension funds, but they tend to be one of the biggest. So to give you a rough sense, for the US, if you're looking at foreign assets of the US, so what US residents hold abroad, 40% or more of the assets of the US are held by an open-end fund or an ETF. So they're a very, very large chunk of the data. The second largest chunk, I believe, it's the insurance companies. They're somewhere above 10%. They're somewhere between 10 and 20%. So the investors that we focus on tend to be big. They tend to be not the only ones. But one of the questions that you can ask is a benchmark the disaggregated data with the aggregate ones. That's what you were asking me. And for most countries, they tend to have a fairly close correspondence. For example, if you were to look at foreign equity holdings of the US or of European countries, They tend to be bilaterally. I mean, so what part of the portfolio goes to, say, from the US to Brazil, from the US to China? They tend to be pretty closely aligned. So we have a fair degree of comfort that the data is representative. Now, of course, there are limitations to this. There are other investors. They're not perfectly correlated. There's certainly heterogeneity, but this can still allow us to go a long way with largely, public data. And by public, I mean commercial, as in other researchers can buy it. And that has been, something that we're very keen on, which is to share the codes, share how you will get the data, and let other researchers build on this. And so that is a huge advantage from our perspective as researchers compared to fully proprietary data that we couldn't possibly imagine other people having. That is also to say that the national statistics, I think, do a pretty good job in many dimensions. They're valuable by all means. But I think the tax havens had become a very large part of these statistics, which made a lot of economists uncomfortable, because we don't think that the capital that goes from the US to the Caymans or from Europe to the Caymans sits there. It gets used somewhere else in the world, and we would like to know where that goes. And that's really where our project comes to life. And I think we found some interesting patterns. I'm going to mention two or three, and then we can sort of jump into them as you see fit. One has been the major increase that you see compared to official statistics of investments from developed countries into emerging markets, in particular into the corporate and debt securities of large corporations. To give you a sense, if you look at the official data of the US, there's about $8 billion worth of corporate debt from Brazil that the US reports owning. Now, that's very small, just economically. Once you unwind the tax havens, that already jumps to $50 billion. And once you take into account also issuance that these corporations might make in other countries that are not tax havens, you get close to $68 billion. So you're moving an order of magnitude away from what you observe in the national statistics, which was the base of our knowledge so far. The other case that I guess we found that we thought was incredibly interesting is investment of the developed world into Chinese equities. If you look at almost any official data from G10 economies, you will find that they tend to have relatively few investments in Chinese equities that get reported into the external assets of these countries. If I remember correctly, the number for the US is $159 billion worth of Chinese equities. That's relatively small, particularly if you want to get a quick order of magnitude, if you compare it to China owning $1 trillion worth of US treasuries. It doesn't seem like the magnitudes are comparable. Now, that one is an artifact, or the number is too low, and it's an artifact of the following phenomenon. Most Chinese technology companies that are listed abroad, large companies like Tencent or Alibaba, tend to be registered in the Cayman Islands. And so when American investors or European investors purchase these securities, they get counted as assets the US owns in the Cayman Islands, not in China. By the time you do this adjustment, the US numbers, for example, jump from being $159 billion to being much closer to $650 billion. So all of a sudden, the exposure that you think you might have to China changes quite substantially. The second thing that we found that relates to this is that while from the US side, this is simply removing assets from the Caymans and sending them to China, an interesting question is what is happening to the Chinese side, to the liabilities of China. And there the phenomenon is it's a little bit different. Why? Because the capital that comes in through the form of FDI. So Alibaba in the Cayman Islands will have affiliates that are Alibaba onshore in China. What more commonly all of us would think of Alibaba as being is the operating company within China. Through a sophisticated chain of corporate shells, the control moves from the shell in the Cayman Islands all the way to the operating company. What this one really does from the perspective of national statistics is it delinks the flows and the stocks of positions that cross the border with China from the stock market value of Alibaba in New York. Now, as it happens, these companies have doubled in value over time. And so there have been extremely large valuation changes that we show in the paper have not been reflected in the liabilities of China, which as a result, they're too small from this perspective. Now, I want to give you a sense of how large this problem can be. We've estimated that about $1 trillion worth of the Chinese net foreign asset position should be taken out, as in it should be added to the liability. So China right now is a $2 trillion creditor to the rest of the world. It's one of the largest global imbalances. It's one where the IMF and a lot of policy have been spent trying to close down this imbalance. And we showed about 50% of that should really not be there from an economic perspective, if that were measured at the full market value of the stocks as they're traded abroad. So this adjustment can be very, very large and can change our view on basic facts of the data that you know we study as economists.
May I, while we are on firms like Alibaba and so on, this question was going to come towards the end. Matteo, you might not have anything to add on this, but one of the reasons these companies are going to Cayman or Luxembourg is the tax haven reasons, but the other one is the capital controls in countries like China, as I understand. So they use these associates, what they are called variable interest entities, and these are the structures designed to avoid China's capital controls. If I may come to this, rising issue of capital flows, sort of management kind of issues. Can countries do these without getting rid of the tax haven problems? Or can we do one of them without, while the other one's still in operation?
Absolutely. So let me divide my answer into two. One that is specific to what you were mentioning about China. The main reason why companies such as Alibaba or Tencent tend to have this relationship with the Cayman Islands and the listed company abroad being the Cayman's company has to do with Chinese regulation that prevents foreign equity ownership in strategically important sectors. And China classifies technology as a strategically important sector. What the companies have done in response is to create a corporate structure called a variable interested entity that you mentioned that effectively allows the following to happen. That the company in the Cayman Island can report according to international accounting standards that it's all one group. So that if you buy a share in Alibaba in the Cayman Islands, you're buying a share in the entire group of Alibaba and all its revenues and liabilities. The company in China will be able to report to the Chinese regulator that they're instead fully owned by the Chinese residents. And so how does the mismatch happen? It happens because they set up an intermediate step, something called a wholly foreign owned enterprise in China that operates in a sector that is not strategic. And that WFOE will enter into a series of contracts with the operating company that will replicate both control and the transfer of profits, which are essentially features of an equity contract. But they will do so technically without using an equity contract. They might use, for example, a loan that collateralizes the asset with as collateral the entire assets of the operating company. They might use a profit transfer agreement, for example, because the WFOE provides consulting services on the website of Alibaba, where the fee for the consulting services is the entire operating revenue of the company. And none of what I'm saying, by the way, I want to be clear, it's our contribution. This has been well known for a while, and the legal scholars have a long literature on these structures. Our contribution was really to look at the economic impact on global capital flows and quantifying the magnitude of what was going on, and the magnitude is really quite staggering. But that's really how this happens, and the paper has a lot more detail. A second part of your question had to do with capital flow management. Certainly, companies do respond to capital controls. We see it in the Chinese case very aggressively, and so a part of the activity in tax haven is induced by companies bypassing the capital controls by issuing abroad. And I think China is not unique in that respect. It's certainly true that, you know, particularly with the financial crisis, from both an economic theory perspective and from an economic policy perspective, we have revised our view on things like capital controls or FX intervention. Much of my theoretical work in exchange rates in different papers had to do with FX intervention. And I think, again, this is all about market segmentation and who's marginal in the markets, who owns the assets, and can you change prices by moving this. The IMF has recently changed their policy stance, as you know, on capital controls, and more recently on FX intervention, which, of course, has been, you know, has been a pretty substantial shift given their earlier positions of, as perhaps one of the stencher defensor of not doing capital controls or FX intervention. I have to say that, you know, the empirical measurement of these policies is still in its infancy. It's something that certainly we would like to do as researchers, but, you know, I think we haven't pinned down the exact effects of capital controls, the exact effects of FX intervention. I think that's part of what we're excited about. And the data getting better, it's going to only help with that. But I don't think as a profession, or certainly us as a specific research team, we're quite there yet. It's a crucial question. We're seeing it these days. I'm sure that you know it much better than me. Emerging markets are experiencing extremely large outflows in response to the COVID-19 crisis. Capital controls are probably coming. Their currencies are depreciating quite aggressively. They might have to do some FX intervention. These are policies that matter. These affect the livelihood of millions of people around the globe, and would like to have better answers for how to do them, effectively.
Yeah, Matteo, thank you for that. I mean, this is obviously topics. These are topics that will occupy us, or hopefully occupy you and your team for some time. And we're really looking forward to sort of the next presence you have for us in this area. Let me take you back to, a little while ago, you talked about your three main results from the study. And the first one you talked about, and just to repeat what you said, I mean, basically, one of the findings is that capital flows to emerging markets are much bigger than previously thought. Would that be a fair assessment? And the second question is, any sort of particular findings for our region, i.e. Southeast Asia or sort of Asia Pacific? We talked about China, but what about some of the other countries?
Absolutely, I think your statement is correct. I would qualify it as I'm talking about positions rather than capital flows. But you know, the two are clearly related. One is the flow, and one is the stock. We tend to focus on the stocks, and it's certainly true that one of the things that we found was a large increase in the bilateral investments coming from developed market investors. So the US, the European Monetary Union, the UK, Australia, Canada, into large emerging markets. It's fairly heavily concentrated in the BRICS, where I'm gonna add an S at the end for South Africa. And it's also extremely concentrated in very large multinationals. And this has to do with their tax havens operation. Clearly, the data speaks to a size dependency, where it's only the largest companies that tend to set up affiliates offshore and have the size and the economic capacity to issue in a tax haven. And those companies tend to attract the disproportionate amount, in percentage at least, of the foreign capital through these foreign subsidiaries. The second element of this has to do with the currency composition. I think as you well know, over time, the sovereign of most emerging markets has switched to issuing or to having most of its debt denominated in local currency. And this is somewhat of a policy success, at least to the extent that it reduces the usual problem of, in a crisis, a currency depreciation being contractionary through a negative wealth effect on the value of the debt, and in particular, allegedly putting limits on the ability to use monetary policy, because as you try to ease, you depreciate even more, getting a further negative effect. we confirmed this as many other people. We find the same pattern in our data. I guess the part that we focus more on is the importance of the corporate sector. It's an artifact of how the statistics are computed that the sovereign debt holdings are almost always correct in the national statistics. Why? Because even a sovereign like Brazil or an East Asian sovereign that goes and issue in New York will do so under its own name. It will not set up a subsidiary in New York to issue. And so the concept of residency or nationality in that case coincides. What this leads to is that at the same time, the corporate sector instead predominantly issues by setting up subsidiaries abroad, whether in the US or in tax havens. And so in the official statistics, the corporate sector tends to be quite small compared to the sovereign. On top of that, it has also been known for a while that the corporate issuance tends to all be in what is called hard currency. So in dollars, euros, in foreign currencies, from the perspective of an emerging market economy. So when you put these two facts together, you get a pretty different picture of the currency composition of total foreign held debt for emerging markets. And this you know, applies also to Asia. In particular, you get a little bit more of a negative view in to the following extent, which is the movement towards local currency has not happened nearly as much as what the official statistics will portray, because the corporate sector has gotten bigger over time and it's all in foreign currency. And so this tells us that today, you know, as we speak, when we have large currency depreciations in emerging markets, those negative wealth effects might well come to bite. Of course, there's a caveat to this, which is we don't have great data on hedges. And I don't mean us particularly, I mean, certainly us as a research team, but I mean it more generally. It's still a part of international capital flows that it's under-investigated. And so there is a possibility that the corporates might have hedged some of this, but it doesn't seem extremely likely, at least not to a meaningful quantitative extent. But it's something that we would like precise answers, and we're not quite there yet.
No, I mean, that was obviously going to be my next question, and you've answered it for me already, in the sense that, you know, a lot of in order to sort of ensure yourself, you would need to have a properly functioning hedging market, hedging products that would allow you to sort of insulate your foreign currency exposure. But thank you for sort of raising that issue.
That also answers a question I was going to ask. You know, given this sort of corporate debt in a foreign currency being bigger in some emerging market economies, what does that mean for these countries in the face of large exchange rate depreciations that we have seen recently? The effects, unless they hedged, as you say, the effects might be bigger than what we thought because the exposures are bigger.
I think that's exactly right. As much as you have read the newspapers of the last few days, and there are many emerging market policymakers, many of the people that are probably part of your consortium, that are pointing out that these effects are happening, they're coming to bite right now, and they can be very big. I mean, as I said, I think one of the reasons we started this is this affects, you know, millions of people around the world, and particularly some of the most exposed people in emerging markets that tend to have less of a safety net, less of an ability of the government through fiscal policy to offset these kind of shocks. And so I am quite worried that we're going to see a wave of defaults from the corporate side that comes from both the lack of cash flows due to the current shock and lockdowns, but also due to these massive issues that we've seen the last few years. The corporate debt market has become very big as also the financing side has changed. As you know, away from the crisis, we move to non-bank financing, where mutual funds and pension funds and insurance companies play a very large role, and the bond market has expanded massively compared to loans. So these, you know, I think that these are crucial issues. Where we would like to make more progress next is trying to trace them at the real level, at the company level, trying to look at hedges. I think you mentioned the heterogeneous ability to hedge depending on how deep is your FX market. For some of these emerging markets, it seems that there is almost no hedging market. For some of them that are bigger, like Brazil, there is more activity. But it, you know, it's still a part that we don't know. I think what's fascinating about our field is, you know, we're getting answers more and more as we get more data, and we either discover new facts or we discover different ways to think about old facts that might not have been necessarily the one. We might not interpret them today the way we interpret five or six years ago, as the data clarifies what's the nature of the economics behind the patterns. I think that's what we're excited about. We think it matters. It matters for policy. It matters for large economies in emerging markets and developed countries. And I think the data is getting infinitely better, and our analysis, our ability to analyze it, it's improving along with it.
On that, let me ask you a two-part question, if I may. Sort of starting with the fact you made it very clear that what you have is a global capital allocation project lab. So it's an ongoing thing. It's a live thing. It's there are people working on it as we speak. If in terms of sort of a wish list to our listeners, what sort of data would you like to receive from anyone listening, if any listener is in a position to provide you information, what would you like to have? What's on your wish list?
That's an interesting question. I have to think about that. It's like kids at Christmas. You want to make sure you ask for the right thing. But let me start with the first part, which is the lab. It's really been an extraordinary experience for me. One, because I'm blessed to have co-authors that are productive people, but they're also incredibly pleasant to work with. Two, because I think we've had an incredible team of younger people that are doing their PhD or they're doing a pre-doc. And really, they've contributed massively to this. But there is an element of this which has to do with your side, which is connecting to policy. I think this has, we've received a number of inquiries from people at central banks around the world asking us about aspects of the paper or aspects of the data. And this is really what we want to do. We want to have a positive impact on the world through our work in the confines of what we do. That often means interfacing with central banks that are trying to solve these problems for themselves, that would like a better view of their country, of their world. And so we try to make the project as open as possible to these kind of interactions. All the codes are online, they're free for people to use. We try to make them as well documented and as easy to use as we could possibly do that. We try to make as much of the data as possible available. Clearly there are restrictions on what we can post and cannot post. But we're trying to share. Also, as I mentioned, the data has many imperfections. We're trying to improve it, and this really has to be a collective effort away from just our team. There are many decisions that go into how you treat the data, and we'll love to hear from some of the listeners things that they found useful, things that they didn't find useful, how they modified this to build on our approach. That's really incredibly useful to us. Or what are key policy questions that they would like to get better answers to, and can we help? To the extent that we can, we would be super keen to do that. I do encourage all central banks to make as much of the data available to researchers as possible. It's the other side of this. I mean, the banks have collected incredibly good data. It's very detailed. And there are, as usual, restrictions. There are things that have to be respected. But setting up a serious research program where researchers can come in within an umbrella that is feasible, particularly younger researchers, PhD students, that's really how we're going to get to better knowledge. It has to be a collective movement and not one researcher here and there. And we're going to build on each other. That's really my major wish list. And many, to be clear, many central banks are doing it already. But I think the extent to which we can do this collectively can go up an order of magnitude, and it will be an amazing positive development for both the fields and the policy side.
Fantastic, thank you. So I have a second question, which is, I'm going to be a bit nosy here, and you said that you looked at 28 million securities or something of that magnitude. I mean, how much of this? I mean, getting to the bottom of this information, I mean, it's sort of a science and an art. I mean, I'm sure you need to be sort of private investigator, private eye in terms of digging down to the level of, you know, going through whatever listing documents or sort of things like that. I mean, how much of this, I mean, how difficult is it to get some of the information?
You know, it's a challenge, but it's also part of what makes it fun, in the sense that it's part of what makes it a research opportunity. Certainly, you know, once you try to do things systematically and at a global level, the challenges do go up, and a lot of the of economics, but also of other related fields in science, have dealt with, you know, big data, with new techniques to harass this, to harness this information and treat it systematically. And for us, that has been a learning slope. And, you know, it's been, for me personally, it's been challenging. I, you know, a lot of my previous work was in applied theory, in particular pencil and paper applied theory. And, you know, I did think that there were these fantastic research opportunities coming up from large data and the ability to get new facts, and I decided to invest with it and find, you know, fantastic authors to do that with. But you know, you learn, and some of the detective work is tedious. I mean, you know, there is this notion out there that our profession is about, you know, breakthroughs that happen one day when you're at the coffee house and you get this brilliant idea, and 2 minutes later it's done. And you know, I spend a lot of time convincing our PhD students that research, real top research, doesn't happen like that. There's a lot of sort of tedious things to do to get to the final results, and the final results might be beautiful, intuitive, simple to explain, hopefully. But you know, there's a long process to get there, and it's part of what you have to do to be serious. You try to do the best you can to make sure that the facts that you're going to say are facts, are truly backed up, they're systematic, they're replicable. And that you really investigate it deep down and you're convinced that that's correct. There's still going to be uncertainties, you know, and particularly with very large data, there's still things that you don't know, things that are not perfect. But, you know, we try to take our time to get to the bottom of things. And it's interesting. I've learned a lot about aspects of the data or of other countries that I never knew before. I mean, I certainly had no notion of, you know, the VAE structures in the Cayman Islands. Until we really dug into it, it was sort of a surprise. And you know, I presented this paper now for the last year or so, and many of my colleagues, who I respect as being the top of the profession and incredibly sharp economists, were surprised by this. And so I take it that I wasn't the only one that was clueless about this a little while back. That's just extremely gratifying. Mm.
I think we have time for one more question.
It's not a question, it's more of a comment. You know, at least a couple of things that I can kind of see that your paper or your data or results kind of overturn in terms of what we knew as profession. One of them is that old famous Lucas quote that why does capital not flow to the developing world or emerging economies? But it seems, no, it does flow. That's
It's an interesting question. So I wouldn't necessarily think that we overturned it. I think we added an element to this that is interesting. A lot of the Lucas literature has to do with multilateral accounts. And so it really depends where you put the Cayman Islands. Other than the point that we made on China, for a lot of the rest, the multilateral accounts are correct. It's just that some of the stuff that should be China is instead the Cayman Islands. But as you aggregate everything up, including the intercompany loans, this might work out. So I think we try to be careful in not drawing that conclusion too far. On the other hand, it's certainly true that if you look at the exposures through the securities markets of, say, the US to emerging markets or Europe to emerging markets, you would have drawn the conclusion that at least as far as equity and corporate bonds are concerned, there isn't a lot of exposure to, say, China or to Brazil. And instead that there is this gigantic exposure to the Cayman Islands. And really, you want to think of our paper as telling you, no, part of that exposure into the Cayman Islands is China. And so if you're thinking that, you know, China might have a major crisis and you want to know what is the negative wealth effect on US households or on European households. That's an important consideration. If you're talking about multilateral statistics, I think China is an exception. We show that those tend to be affected by these offshore centers. But in a lot of cases, those might turn out to be roughly correct as they are. So I think there's a, you know, there's a lot more as you go deeper into the research and how to interpret it that I think also models are required to make further progress. And I'm hopeful that, you know, people will build on this data, trying to figure out exactly what you have in mind. To what extent does this vary the efficiency of capital allocations, global resharing? A lot of those statements require more structure in terms of models and more assumptions, but that can be very interesting.
Fantastic. Matteo, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you, Azir, as well, for being on the call. I'm a bit embarrassed now. It's the website is www.globalcapitalallocation.com.
No reason to be embarrassed. You have it exactly right. I can hardly remember it myself. It is indeed www.capitalallocation.com.
Okay. As you heard, Matteo is always pleased to receive emails from interested parties. So if you have questions or if you want to provide him with data, please feel free to go ahead. Matteo, thank you so much for joining us today and talking about your paper with Brent and Jesse, which is forthcoming in the Journal of Political Economy, I believe.
The first paper, yeah, it's forthcoming.
Okay, excellent. So keep your eyes peeled for the paper and for loads more results coming from the Global Capital Allocation Project. I'm looking forward to see what the website is up, obviously updated frequently. So I'll be interested to see what the guys come up next. So thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening, and stay safe, and all the best.
Thank you so much.